Hi, everyone, and welcome to Remaking Tomorrow, a series of conversations about the future of teaching and learning. I'm Ryan Radzeski, here with Greg Baer. We are the co-authors of When You Wonder, You're Learning, Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids.
This is a podcast powered by Remake Learning, a network that ignites engaging, relevant, and equitable learning in support of young people navigating rapid social and technological change.
On today's episode, we're talking with John B. King, Jr., Chancellor of the State University of New York, or SUNY, the largest system of public higher education in the United States. Before taking the helm at SUNY, John held several leadership roles in our nation's education system, including serving as Secretary of Education under President Barack Obama. Chancellor King, welcome to Remaking Tomorrow.
Thanks so much. Excited to talk with you.
All good stories start at the beginning, so let's start at the beginning. You are the son of a former public school teacher and a school guidance counselor, and your parents tragically passed away at a young age, and you've credited your New York City public school teachers with providing you with essential life guidance. Can you tell us about some of those teachers? Who stands out all these years later?
When I was 8, in October of 4th grade, my mom passed away. And I had a teacher, Mr. Osterweil, Alan Osterweil, who was my teacher at PS 276 in Canarsie, Brooklyn. And Mr. Osterweil was my teacher for 4th, 5th, and 6th grade. He looped with us, which was very unusual in the New York City public schools of the time. And that was also a period during which my father was increasingly sick. My father had then undiagnosed Alzheimer's, and home was incredibly difficult. I didn't know what my father would be like from one night to the next. Some nights he'd be angry, some nights sad, some nights violent. And the thing that saved me was Mr. Osterweil's classroom. And I remember the things we did in his class like it was yesterday. We read the New York Times every day, 4th, 5th, 6th grade. We did productions of A Midsummer Night's Dream and Alice in Wonderland. I remember the field trips we would take, Museum of Natural History, the ballet, the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And his classroom was this place where I was safe, where I could be a kid when I couldn't be a kid at home, where I felt cared about. And I'm still in touch with Mr. Osterweil. Had lunch with him a few weeks ago. He saved my life during that period. After I left PS 276, I went to Mark Twain Junior High School in Coney Island. By that point, my father was very sick. Home was incredibly difficult. I was figuring out how to get food in our house, how to keep our household going. And I didn't know why my father was acting the way he was, so that made it even more difficult. And I had a teacher, Miss D, my 7th grade social studies teacher, Celestine Desajour. She was a former actress who, again, just made class so compelling and interesting and engaging that at least when I was in her classroom, I wasn't thinking about all the other things that were going on in my life. I remember one project we did on the Aztecs, and I was the Aztec sportscaster in our Aztec news broadcast. And in that moment, the thing that mattered most in the world was to be the best Aztec sportscaster there had ever been, rather than thinking about what my father was going to be like that night when I got home. And I'm very grateful to her and to Mr. Osterweil. And then after my dad passed, I moved around different family members, different schools, but it was always teachers who gave me a sense of hope and purpose.
Thank you for sharing that. And our listeners won't be surprised after hearing that you then began your own career as a teacher. You started as a history teacher in Puerto Rico and then Boston before going on to help found the Roxbury Prep Charter School in Boston. And we're curious what lessons you took from your time, you know, on the other side of the classroom as a teacher and then later as a school administrator. How did that get you thinking about systems? And how did that set you up? How did it prepare you for the leadership roles you'd eventually go on to hold?
Well, I loved teaching. It really was a chance to try to do for other kids what Mr. Osterweil and Miss D and other teachers had done for me. You know, I felt very blessed by the trust that parents place in you to send their children to you. I felt that way as a teacher and as a principal at Roxbury Prep. In my experiences as a teacher and principal, I was always thinking about some of the systemic implications of the work. When I was teaching in Boston, I was teaching at a high school, we were getting students from middle school who were multiple grade levels behind in math, in reading, and really trying to work to get them ready for college. Our goal was to have our students go on to college after attending our school. And it was very difficult to make up all the ground. And I had been trained at Columbia Teachers College as a social studies teacher. I loved talking about primary source documents. And, you know, what I found was that many of my students couldn't access those primary source documents, couldn't access even textbook levels of text because their reading skills were so weak. And so I had to kind of learn how to support struggling readers. And I ended up deciding to found a middle school really because of what I saw at the high school level and really a belief that if we started earlier, we could prepare students better so that when they got to high school, they'd be on the trajectory to go on to college. You know, we built our school, it was very small, just about 200 students, sixth through eighth grade. We got fantastic results. We're the highest performing urban middle school in Massachusetts. But, you know, the things we were doing felt scalable. I mean, we had a longer school day. We were incredibly rigorous in the selection of teachers and the evaluation and support of teachers. We had teachers come back 3.5 weeks before the school year began each year to prepare the curriculum for the year, but also to really dig into student work from the prior year so they would know the needs of the students who were coming to them. Those things felt like we could do them at scale. And so I ended up gravitating towards public policy with a desire to try to get better outcomes at scale. You know, I felt like I'd been lucky that teachers had intervened in my life at the right moment, but I don't think folks' fate should depend on luck. We should have systems that deliver great school experiences for all of our kids.
Now, John, we're going to come back to public policy and come back to systems because those are interesting bits and moments in your professional career. But let's fast forward in your story. Because Ryan and I can just imagine how lucky your students and their families and your colleagues were to have you there in Roxbury. And we know the same is true right now at the State University of New York, where you joined in January 2023, assuming leadership responsibility for the 64 college and university campuses that incredibly are located within 30 miles of every home, school, and business in New York State. So tell us about this system called SUNY. What makes it so special?
You know, SUNY is an incredible community of institutions where there is a place for every New York student. We have the full range of institutions. We have community colleges. We have four-year colleges that are regional in their focus. We have technical colleges that are focused on particular career areas. And we have four phenomenal major research universities. And across that system, we are serving exactly the students public higher education was meant to serve. We are serving a significant percentage of low-income students, middle-income students, veterans, first-gen students, single moms who are going to school at the same time working, just trying to get ahead for their family, the full range. And we've got about 370,000 students in degree programs. We've got about 1.3 million students who come through our various courses and workforce development programs, as well as degree programs over the course of a year. So the scale of impact is incredible. Many of our campuses are, you know, at the top of national lists that are created of engines of social mobility because so many of the students, once they leave us, are able to achieve economic opportunity for themselves and their families that otherwise would not have been possible. So there are lots of things we're working on to keep getting even better, focused on student success. We want to double the research and scholarship that takes place across our campuses. So we're working with the governor, Governor Kathy Hochul, to make sure we've got the investments in areas like artificial intelligence, climate change, semiconductor industry, biotech, so we can continue to grow our research impact. We are very committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion. While other states are going backwards on those issues, we are pushing forward because we want to serve a population of students that's fully representative of the state. We want our faculty and our leadership to represent the state. We are very focused on economic development and upward mobility because at the end of the day, we have a mission to serve our students and we have a mission to serve the state. And every area of economic need for the state, from healthcare to advanced manufacturing, is going to need the students that we prepare at SUNY.
John, we talk so often on this podcast about the work of Fred Rogers and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and it strikes me as you're talking about SUNY that SUNY really is a neighbor. It's so much more than a place where you come for a year or two and you get your degree and you move on. And I'm wondering, you know, having spent some time in this system now, how do you think about higher education's role in sparking civic engagement and creating those good neighbors and good citizens?
Yeah, a couple things I'd say. One is, as part of our commitment to our students, we need to prepare them for economic opportunity, but we also need to prepare them to be good citizens. And we're doing a lot of work on civic discourse across our campuses, making sure that we build that into our general education requirements so that students are leaving us ready to have healthy, constructive disagreements with their neighbors. We are also doing a lot of work to get students involved in service. We just launched something called the Empire State Service Corps, 500 SUNY students who will do 300 hours a year of paid public service work. And if they're eligible, many of them will receive the AmeriCorps Education Awards at the end of that year. And they're doing things like tutoring, working on environmental issues, working on anti-hate, anti-bias projects in their community. We're doing a lot to make sure students participate in the election in a nonpartisan way, but we want our students to vote. And we have the majority of our campuses are part of the All-In Campus Challenge, working to get students registered and excited about participating in the election. So that's one piece, is the student-focused piece. But another piece is that the institutions themselves, they need to be partners with the community and make sure that their programs and activities serve community needs. And so our community colleges are working closely with their local hospitals to train the healthcare workforce that's needed. Our campuses that are in the Syracuse area are working closely with Micron, that's going to bring thousands of semiconductor industry jobs to the region. So that kind of close partnership is foundational to who we are at SUNY.
John, for so many years, you have been an architect of sorts. You've been building community. And to return to a previous moment in your professional trajectory, you were Commissioner of Education for the state of New York. And so think back to that role as commissioner. You're leading New York's educational efforts, and you really focused on the collaboration between pre-K to grade 12 schools and the state's colleges and universities. What was the impetus for that at the time, and how do you see that work continuing today?
Well, it's so important that we support the whole student through their development, right? And the goal shouldn't be just a high school diploma of our P-12 system. It should be for students to be prepared when they leave P-12 for success in college and careers, for the next thing. And for higher ed institutions, they have a responsibility to train our teachers and to make sure that they are helping create a positive ecosystem for K-12 education. So to me, the collaboration is core to the mission of both K-12 and higher ed. One of my favorite projects I worked on when I was commissioner that we continue to work on at SUNY now is an initiative called PTEC, where students graduate from high school with a high school diploma, an associate's degree, and first in line for a job at an employer partner. And the first version of PTEC was in Brooklyn. It was a school that was sited in a building that had been a failing high school. It was a replacement school. And serving a largely low-income population of students of color, actually disproportionately boys. And that school's success led us to scale it across the state with different employer partners. Many of the higher ed partners were SUNY campuses and continued to be. And that level of collaboration where you're helping students in high school understand how is what I'm learning today connected to my professional future can be so, so powerful. So I love that project. We've got a project we're working on now at SUNY around the science of reading and making sure that our teacher preparation programs help our teachers learn the best research about how students learn to read. And we've built a micro-credential at SUNY New Paltz for current teachers to get a deeper understanding of the science of reading. So I see this collaboration as fundamental to serving the state well.
This is Ryan Rudzeski here with Greg Baer. We're talking with John B. King Jr., the Chancellor of the State University of New York.
John, in the fall of 2015, U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan announced that he'd be stepping down from his position at the U.S. Department of Education. And at the time, you're the Deputy Secretary. President Obama announces that you will succeed Duncan in leading the nation's Department of Education. Now, I don't know if that happens in an email, a meeting, some sort of notice, a text. I don't know what happens, right? But I can only imagine you in that moment, drawing upon your memories as a student and then a teacher and an administrator and then a commissioner. What's running through your mind as President Obama announces that you will be leading the nation's schools?
I thought a lot about my parents. You know, they both spent their whole careers in the New York City public schools. And I think both would credit the New York City public schools for their life trajectories. You know, my dad was African-American, grew up in a very segregated New York City just after the turn of the 20th century, and really found a path to opportunity as a teacher, principal, and administrator in the New York City schools. My mom had come to the Bronx from Puerto Rico, where she was born. As a five-year-old, had learned English in the New York City public schools, was the first in her family to go to college, and became a teacher and then a guidance counselor in the New York City schools. So thought a lot about them and the dreams that they had had and the opportunity to try to continue to advance those dreams and their vision for the transformative power of education. I thought a lot about the teachers who made such a difference in my life, without whom not only would I not have become U.S. Secretary of Education, I don't know that I would have been alive, but for those teachers who made such a difference for me. And of course, I felt tremendous responsibility to use the opportunity to serve to try to make things better for the kids who are so often left behind, and the adults. I mean, you know, as secretary, you're not only overseeing K-12, but also higher education. And so thinking about how could we make sure the U.S. Education Department is a driver of expanded opportunity?
You know, I actually want to ask you about your father, John B. King Sr. He was a career educator of 40 years himself. Like you mentioned, the first Black principal in Brooklyn, went on to serve as assistant superintendent of schools for New York City. And he believed that, quote, education could save lives, which is a sentiment you yourself have shared lots of different times. And I'm wondering, in light of that, and everything you've seen across this country, everything you've done in the world of education, and as we look ahead to a changing world, changing in terms of artificial intelligence, changing in terms of the economy, in what ways do you think learning needs to evolve to meet the most pressing needs of children, young people, and their families? Thinking about, you know, if you yourself were in school starting all over again today, what is it that you would want that young John King Jr. to have, to experience?
Well, some things are eternal, right? The relationship between teachers and students, that relationship is so foundational to what school means in the lives of young people. The joy of learning, the content may be different across different time periods or different continents, but at the end of the day, the joy in learning, the spark of curiosity, the skill of asking questions and trying to discover what you need to learn, that's fundamental, and that should always be present in classrooms. And I was fortunate to have classrooms that both had those relationships, those caring relationships, and that joy of learning. But I do think, you know, one thing that has certainly evolved is the need for students to navigate a world that is very different technologically. And some of that is about learning to use new tools like artificial intelligence or even the ability to access so much information through the internet and understanding how do you find good information. So there's learning to use new tools, but there's also learning discernment around those tools. And that's going to be increasingly important in a world of things like deep fakes, right? The ability to to ask questions. Is this from a reliable source? How do I know what information was used to create this website, or what databases did this artificial intelligence access in order to give me this response to my query or to my prompt? The ability to navigate social media and still have perspective about your own identity and not kind of lose yourself in the pressures that social media creates. That's a new set of skills that we've got to make sure our students have.
Chancellor King, it's as if you enter the school of Fred Rogers. You so brilliantly connected what is forever timeless and classic, like deep and caring relationships, with what is attractive to today's young people and what they want, need, and deserve. That's what Mr. Rogers did for half a century, and it's what you're doing today. Thank you.
Let me say that's very kind. I was a devoted, probably not surprisingly, as a Gen Xer, I was a devoted fan of Mr. Rogers. And so that's very, very kind.
Well, we mean it. Before we go, we have just one more question for you, please. What's one thing that parents and educators can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every learner?
You know, I'll share an answer that President Obama gave in a conversation with a group of young people. The question that the young people had asked him is, what were the keys to success in his life? And he talked about the value of hard work, and then he talked about the power of reading. And he made the point that he had been fortunate in his life to live in multiple different communities, places around the world. His family is diverse, and so that had helped him develop empathy. But he said one of the keys to developing empathy is reading, because when you read, you inhabit the worldview of the central character in a novel, or you inhabit the worldview of the person who has written their autobiography or the subject of a biography. You get to see things through their eyes, experience things that they experience. You get to know worlds that you might never yourself visit or travel to, whether it's from periods in history or places around the world that you might not see or communities that you might know. And you learn about them and you develop that habit. When you're interacting with people, think about how the world occurs for them. And he described it so beautifully, and it really stuck with me. And I think, you know, when parents are thinking about what to do with their kids, even after they're past the age where they need you to read the story to them, they still want you to read the story to them. You should still read with them. Middle schoolers, they want to be read to, and you should still find a way to read with them. And even if you have high schoolers, picking a book that you read together or sharing an essay that you've read that was interesting or a poem, that experience of accessing new worlds, new experiences through text, so powerful, so beautiful, to me, so foundational to education. And I hope your listeners will look for opportunities to read themselves and to encourage the young people in their lives to read and ideally to read together.
Thank you so much for that. Greg and I we just had the pleasure of being in a high school classroom in which the teacher sits down and he reads a book to his students once a semester. And after they get over the initial shock that the teacher is reading to them, it's one of their favorite experiences of the whole year. Thanks so much to John B. King Jr., the Chancellor of the State University of New York. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.